tension there.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency to order Thursday, March 21st. Are you okay down there?
Kim's here.
Yes, I'm here. Representative Thatcher's here.
Today, we're going to start out with public hearings on House Bill 2828, House Bill 3168, House Bill 3330, and House Bill 3331. And we won't be hearing House Bill 3070 today. We'll be carrying that one over. And we will not be working House Bill 2856. And we will not be working House Bill 2536. And for right now, I think that's enough information. So, we'll see. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on concurrently on House Bill 2828, House Bill 3168, House Bill 3330, and House Bill 3331. Bob, do you care to give us a short description of what these four bills are?
I will be as brief as possible, Mr. Chair.
Very brief. Just give us an idea of what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2828 requires the Department of State Police to establish a fingerprint retention program and requires the department to notify a subscribed agency or district if the department receives information relating to the administration of criminal justice regarding the individual on whom the department conducted a criminal records check. House Bill 3331 requires the Department of State Police to establish a voluntary central criminal records check registry. House Bill 3330 requires governmental agencies to utilize electronic fingerprint capture for purpose of taking fingerprints for conducting criminal records checks. And House Bill 3168 requires the Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules specifying categories of individuals subject to criminal records checks, the information to be required of each category, and additional certain information. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Nathanson. Good afternoon and welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13, and I am indeed very glad to be back in front of your committee again. I've been working on issues related to criminal background checks for going on a couple of years now, and it's always so great when you realize that the efforts of concerted work and collaboration with other legislators and with state agencies yields fruit. That's not just a report that gets put on a shelf, but you actually start seeing that change could be possible. Dozens of occupations in the private and public sector require a criminal background check, like home care workers, school employees, dentists, physicians, counselors, therapists, escrow agents, funeral service providers. Separate background checks are required for an individual working at the same occupation for different businesses or in different counties, creating additional work and additional expenses. The expense and time add up to another burden that's placed on the individual. It's placed on nonprofit organizations, on businesses, on schools, and on state agencies. We're talking about multiple background checks, costly and time-consuming procedures. Dozens of these agencies, boards, and commissions that have the authority to do the licensing and the criminal background checks have developed their own rules independently of one another, which results in a hodgepodge of procedures. That means a hodgepodge of extra costs for Oregonians. A few of you who were around in the previous session heard stories about multiple background checks for the same person. Delays in certifying someone to take care of a disabled person, or delays in certifying someone to go to work for a nonprofit agency. This increases the nuisance and burden factor for the people applying for the jobs, and it increases the nuisance and burden for the businesses or the organizations trying to hire workers. House Bill 4091, in the last session, established a work group to convene stakeholders and examine potential opportunities for a streamlined process. And I want to underscore that what we have in Oregon right now is not a statewide process for criminal background checks. We have several dozen agencies that each have their own autonomous process. Additionally, it's unclear how many local courts share conviction and judgment records with the state, and that's something else that I'm going to talk to the Judiciary Committee about later. So in 2012, the legislature passed House Bill 4091, which signaled an intent to make a change. It says we're going to do things better. To change from a disjointed set of non-coordinated and autonomous, completely autonomous processes to something more like a system, not necessarily a single system, but something that will be better and more streamlined, that will still work to protect Oregonians. It will be better for the state agencies that are engaged in the work, and it will help Oregonians who are trying to get jobs that require those checks. The work group was established. It met several times over several months, and someone is here who can answer questions for you more specifically about who was on the group and how many times they met. One of the things they did was, early in their work, was they conducted a survey of all those agencies and commissions that are doing background checks. And that survey does illustrate what we already thought to be the case. Those different protocols, and this is my interpretation, this is not their words, for all those different protocols, there really wasn't much justification for why all of them had to be different from one another's. It was just, that's the way we do it. The work group prepared a very useful report, and I want to thank everyone who was involved in that. It includes several recommendations, and out of those recommendations, I have had four bills prepared, and those are the bills that the chair has opened for public hearing today. The objective of this package of bills is to streamline the criminal background check system, to improve administration, to lower cost for individuals that are subject to background checks, and to ensure that law enforcement officials have a complete picture as well. You're going to hear about LiveScan, which is about electronic fingerprints instead of the old paper and ink method. You'll hear about trying to improve the portability of a background check, meaning if I got my background check to work as a home care worker in this home on this street in this town, if I want to have a job doing the same work in a home that's three blocks away, maybe you could be able to do it without another background check. So we're going to hear about standardizing criteria, we'll hear about a clean box voluntary system, and also about having Oregon participate more fully in a federal system called Wrap Back. I think we should be moving forward and starting to implement change, not just keep talking about change. I hope that some of this may be new to you, but that all of it will be useful to you. These bills will not compromise public safety, and in fact, in a few ways, will improve our efforts to protect children, protect seniors, and to protect other Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. We'll go ahead and listen to your testimony unless someone has a question for Representative Nathanson right off. Great. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Lawson, and I am a senior human resource consultant with the Chief Human Resources Office within the Department of Human Services, Department of Administrative Services. I will be speaking briefly on the following four criminal records bills before you today. Our office was tasked in 2012 by House Bill 4091 to convene a work group and provide a report of recommendations for performing criminal records checks in Oregon. That final report was submitted to your interim committee on December 10th, 2012, and I provided another copy of it for you today. First, I'd like to talk about House Bill 2828. It provides the opportunity for Oregon State Police to retain fingerprints in specific non-criminal circumstances to reduce the need for resubmission of prints. It directs and gives Oregon State Police rulemaking authority to establish a program to accomplish this. The retained prints will then be used to develop an Oregon-only wrapback system. Wrapback creates a system in which the interested agency receives notification of new criminal activity, which has the potential of eliminating the need for rechecks. This continuous evaluation of a subject individual's criminal records will result in more immediate responses to concerning behavior and will lead to increased safety of vulnerable populations. This is further described on page 14 of our final report in the section titled Exploring the Use of a Single Wrapback Program. Then there's House Bill 3168, and it reduces the overall amount of criminal records checks in Oregon by all agencies. It allows for portability of fitness determinations across programs and authorized agencies and shifts the focus of criminal records checks from the agency and program to the population being served. It provides the Department of Administrative Services in consultation with Oregon State Police rulemaking authority over the criteria for criminal records checks. This would reduce the number of criminal records checks by not requiring multiple checks when possible for individuals who are working and or volunteering in more than one capacity with the same population category. This bill would provide consistency across the state. I would also like to assure agencies that should this bill pass, the Department of Administrative Services would lead a very collaborative process with stakeholders to ensure rules were written in the best way possible to ensure we create a more efficient and effective criminal records check process for the state and its citizens. This recommendation of the work group is further described on page 19 of the final report in the section titled Apply Similar Criteria and Fitness Determination Within Logical Clusters. Then there is House Bill 3330, and it mandates all fingerprints be captured for criminal records checks to be done so through electronic capture or live scan technology. As of April 2012, the federal government stopped accepting hard copy prints and went to only accepting prints nationwide through electronic capture. In Oregon, the majority of all applicant fingerprint-based records checks currently have fingerprints captured on ink and paper. The hard card prints are then converted to electronic prints for submission to the federal government. The hard card prints are then, this bill also requires agencies designated by the state of Oregon to report, receive, and disseminate criminal offending information to conduct a study and report the results on or before October 1st, 2014. This study will require agencies to analyze their existing processes and seek additional opportunities to streamline their processes that make them more efficient and effective. This recommendation of the work group is further described on page 20 of our final report in the section titled Increase the Use of Electronic Fingerprint Processing, e.g. live scan at point of capture. And then lastly, I'd like to speak about House Bill 3331, which creates a voluntary registry administered by the Oregon State Police, into which individuals with no criminal history can pay a fee to enroll in the ability to have fewer repeat criminal records checks. Enrollment requires a fingerprint-based records check that meets Oregon State Police's requirements. And then once enrolled, the subject individual would then have their record automatically checked quarterly through the law enforcement data system. Enrollment would expire after 2 years. This registry could be used by authorized agencies who participate in lieu of repeat criminal records checks. Therefore, this bill would result in a reduction of repeat criminal records checks and fingerprint captures, creating a more efficient and effective criminal records checks process in Oregon. This recommendation of the work group is further described on page 19 of our final report in the section titled Establish Clean Box Registries Where Practical Within Logical Clusters. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Do we have questions right off the bat? I know this is a big subject area that we haven't spent a lot of time on yet this session. So, question. Representative Richardson.
Question is on the security of the data. when we went through the whole discussion about Real ID, it all sounded so good, except that there was really no protection of the data. The federal government said basically just trust us, but we don't want to encrypt or anything like that. How can the citizens of Oregon be assured that this data will be secure and that their privacy will be retained?
Do you want to take that? Do you want me to take that? Yeah, she'd be best to take that. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there is a representative from Oregon State Police here today, I believe, who might want to respond to that.
Okay, thank you.
As a professional.
We'll have her come up now. She's already on her way.
I'd also like to add that we have an amendment prepared, which you may want to consider. If you start looking at details of the clean box or voluntary registry system, we do have an amendment prepared for some additional points you may want to consider, which would allow for voluntary withdrawal from that registry should you want to, and also to consider less frequent checks instead of quarterly, maybe semi-annual or annual.
Thank you. And from the State Police, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, for the record, Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police, CJIS Division. Thank you for asking the question, and I will do my best to answer. So Representative Richardson and Chair Holby, regarding the security of the data, you were specifically referring to the FBI or the feds, and in most of these proposed bills, the records of the data are not retained there, just like they are today. We actually would be retaining any of that data here in the state of Oregon. But daily, we are submitting electronic images of fingerprints for the FBI fingerprint background check for these services. And there is, in statute currently, does not allow for the FBI to retain any image or any copy of that data. And I know that they have processes in place, so I can get that detail for you if need be, regarding the electronic images and the data that they purge on a regular basis.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Lively.
So I think it was our last meeting we talked some about technology across departments in the state and some efforts to potentially streamline and improve. And so as I listen to this, it appears it's fairly dependent upon technology and the technology working across lines. And so I'm just curious as to the state of that in relationship to passing these and doing this. So where do we stand in the ability, I guess, to implement?
I'll take that question as well, Chair Holby and Representative Lively. We do have, of course, live scan capability in now all of the counties for criminal justice purposes. So there's a representative of that in each of the county jails or booking facilities, and that's used on a regular basis. We are also using live scan and our interface with the FBI to, again, daily, hourly transmit fingerprint data to them. So we do have the infrastructure. There are some pieces, of course, programming and applications for, you know, new databases for this purpose that would need to be built. But there is basically the main infrastructure in place.
So back to Representative Richardson's question, in specifically in terms of House Bill 2828. The federal Rat Back program, would that same answer apply to that bill as far as those records needing to be not being able to be kept by the FBI?
Chair Holby and members of the committee, yes, that as I read the 2828 currently, it does not speak to retention at the FBI level and refers to Statute 181534, the process is in place for current background checks, and in that statute specifically prohibits the FBI from keeping that information. So that's why in this particular form it would be considered Oregon only. So the check initially would be a state and FBI check, but then from there on it would only be a state check.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, I think you sort of answered my question in that, for instance, if you want to go ahead and buy a gun, you have to get this background check. You don't have to have fingerprinting yet, but you do get a background check. So initially you're saying that would apply, but then after that, would those records also apply if somebody wanted to voluntarily register 3331, would they be able to use? Would it work either way? If I went into the voluntary registry, did my fingerprinting, and within a couple days I wanted to go get my, buy a gun, would any of this apply or not?
Chair Holvey and Representative Thatcher, this particular bill doesn't speak to the background check for firearms, but something like that certainly could be done. I know that the FBI does have a process similar. It requires the purchaser to provide their fingerprints if they want to voluntarily get what's a universal sort of PIN number if they have something in their background that just continues to be problematic. This would be separate from that.
And then one other follow-up question. Right now, to obtain a CHL or concealed handgun license, you go to the sheriff's office to get fingerprinted. Would this fold in any of that?
And Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, I don't read that this has anything to do with the statutes that are mentioned in this particular, this series of bills does not include that statute.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Really appreciate all the work that the work group has done. I know they spent a lot of time on this, and from House Bill 4091 and Representative Nathanson as well for participating in that, and I will see how far we can go, and I think this is a great efficiency effort, and I'm hopeful that it'll actually help us save some money and without compromising the security of people who are engaged in working for our agencies. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So up next we have, who do we have up next? Megan Moyer and Mark Nystrom. And did Doug Riggs want to testify or just be recognized he's in support? Okay.
Chair Holvey, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We represent over 55,000 workers here in the state of Oregon, over 20,000, which we call our care provider members, our direct service providers, who provide such services as in-home care seniors, home care services to people with developmental disabilities and mental illness, adult foster care providers, child care providers, and nursing home workers. All of those workers, include and others that work in other state agencies, must have criminal background checks to qualify for employment. But many of them have to go through criminal background checks multiple times due to the way that we have set up our system. For example, somebody who becomes a CNA to work in a nursing facility will first have to get a CNA to get a criminal background check to get their CNA, which is done by the Board of Nursing. They then will do another, and often within the course of a month or two, criminal background check for the facility in which they want to work. If that individual would like to work at more than one nursing facility owned by the same employer, they must get a criminal background check per facility they would work in. If they wanted to, then many nursing home providers also have home health services. If they were to pick up a shift doing home health work, they would again have to do a criminal background check policy. For the purposes of adult foster care providers, every home that they establish, they must go through that process, not just for themselves, but every family member living in that home or worker. If a and often at the expense of the adult foster care provider. If the adult foster care provider has a worker who's working in one home, they would like that worker to also pick up shifts in another home they own. That worker must have a criminal background check done again before they're allowed to work in that other home, regardless of if they did it a week ago.
All of this is extremely expensive. Most of our policies do not allow workers to begin work until the results and determination are back from criminal background checks, delaying the availability of needed workers, and also delaying the availability of care for those who need it most. We see the issue of access to care primarily with home care workers. When an individual chooses a loved one or someone they know to provide care, that person cannot begin to provide care until the criminal background check process is complete, which, depending on if they've lived out of state or need a more thorough check, can be several weeks. So anything that can be done to streamline the criminal background check process, SEIU is highly supportive of. We also are particularly supportive of House Bill 2828 regarding establishing a wrap-back process. This is an issue that SEIU has been engaged in for several years and have really thankful for the leadership of Representative Nathanson around this. The wrap-back process would also greatly enhance the level of safety and protection available within services to people with disabilities. That is because once you have a criminal record check done and you remain in your workplace and you remain at your job, we do not require that you have another criminal background check. Incidents can happen between that time and if that individual gets another check that an employer would have absolutely no knowledge about. Those could be incidents that would make it unsafe for that individual to continue to provide care. The wrap-back system is one that is periodically pinged against new arrests and convictions. And so an individual who is placed on wrap-back, if they have a new conviction, it would notify the state police, who would then notify that agency who oversees that, and an evaluation would be done at that time if they continue to be an appropriate care provider. We really believe that that helps provide greater protection for individuals receiving care and services. And the last issue I want to end with is that we are extremely supportive of trying to streamline and rationalize our criminal background check processes for different workforces. Having so many different types of workers and each one having its own special rules about how it works, I do understand the complexity. The only area that I caution about, and this is not specific to the bill, but I think it is extremely important as we look to establish what those criteria will be for different types of workers, that we be very cognizant both of the civil liberties of workers, the use and appropriate use of substantiated abuse and neglect claims, and also that we be very rational and thoughtful about creating crimes that are permanently disqualifying that may not be necessarily appropriate. I think it's extremely important when looking at criminal records that we're able to understand what poses a legitimate risk in care and what may be a history that an individual has overcome. So I hope that that will continue to be part of the conversation. Thank you.
I appreciate the testimony. And to your last point, you know, that those particular issues would be taken up by the Judiciary Committee and not pertinent to these particular bills. But really appreciate your thorough explanation of your position on these bills. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom. I'm the Human Services Policy Manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm also here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'd like to start off by thanking Representative Nathanson for her leadership on the government efficiency issues. AOC and AOC-MHP support 2828. We really, truly believe that they will have an impact on reducing administrative burden. Many staff and social service workforces often move across areas of mental health, addictions, DD, and corrections. And on top of that, they're moving between private and public sectors. And as you've heard, oftentimes there's separate checks conducted. The system to us seems redundant and uncoordinated, and we believe that this bill will go a long way in addressing that problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs. I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to Children's Programs. We are the 43 nonprofits statewide that deal with kids at risk. You know, in this era of, I'm not going to read the testimony you have in front of you, but I will just make one or two points. In this era of budget cuts, and many of our programs have been severely reduced in the last 15, 20 years, every nickel and dime that an agency has to spend for additional red tape, bureaucracy, or delay means a nickel, dime, or a dollar less being spent on the kids that we intend to serve. And so while the issue of criminal background checks might seem unimportant or less important than some other topics, this is actually a very, very important topic for our agencies. It not only leads to higher costs, but it leads to higher delays, and in many cases it leads to staff who we'd like to hire moving on to some other opportunity because they simply cannot wait for that process to take place. So the redundancy and requirements, the costs, the waiting periods, et cetera, really are a hindrance to our groups. So I won't go into any detail. I think Megan and Representative Nathanson did a really good job of outlining the bills. Suffice it to say that we're very supportive. We really appreciate her leadership, and we hope that we can work with you on these bills as they move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any questions for this group? Thanks a lot for your testimony. And Representative Frederick, do you have time crunches?
No, go ahead.
Thank you. I have two more people left to testify on these bills, Becky Strauss and Jan Aho. And we'll let Jan go first.
That's fine. Thanks.
Okay.
She's almost a constituent.
That's very nice.
Yeah, really.
Thank you.
Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chairman Holvey and committee members. My name is Jan Aho. I was a director of the Probuck Preschool for many years before I was hired as the executive director of Probuck Center in February of 2010. I was very pleased when Representative Nathanson visited our organization in the fall of 2010 and listened to our concerns. And it was a meeting with other providers of services to adults with developmental disabilities. And she was really looking at ways, because we were talking about revenue, and she was looking at ways to increase efficiency. And for me, as the director of preschool for many years, one of the things that I was very concerned about was the cumbersome and the duplication of efforts when I was trying to get criminal background checks for the employees and volunteers that were working in the program. What I was really, and I appreciate that she listened, and not only listened, but she has taken action and had the bill that was presented and formed the committee and is presenting options for us to, I think, really streamline the system, and specifically bills like House Bill 3168. I'm not the only director of an organization that's frustrated by the cumbersome and often confusing and sometimes and mostly costly steps needed to get a criminal background check for our staff and volunteers. The problem is even further compounded when we have a person who has moved in from another state. What you have to complete and what you have to do is different in each of the systems. Therefore, we welcome a more streamlined, centralized system that functions better not only for the employee but also the organization and ultimately the vulnerable populations we serve. At Probuck Center, we serve not only adults with intellectual developmental disabilities, but we also have a preschool for young children whose parents have cognitive issues. Therefore, under the same building, in the same building, we have young children and we have adults. And we have to have criminal background checks for each population. So our staff have to have criminal background checks, in some cases fingerprints, from not only the child care division, but also from DD and the MH system. So they each require different paperwork. I had a case where an employee thought they had filled out the paperwork because they got the card, they did everything, but realized that there were two systems, so their employment was delayed because they had to go through and complete the paperwork for the child care division. It's not unusual that that happens. And Representative Nathanson and the committee that did the work that they did found just what we experienced, that it's cumbersome, it's more complex than we think is necessary, and is in need of being streamlined. Therefore, I join other providers in fully supporting her efforts to improve these processes. We welcome the day when there is a simplified, efficient criminal records check system here in Oregon. That said, I understand that reviews done on these bills by the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, which is our nonprofit provider association that represents Pearl Buck Center and other organizations, and they participated in the work done by the group and by DHS and others, that there may be some amendments necessary to ensure that Representative Nathanson's goals of cost and time efficiency combined with public safety can be adequately met. I don't have the expertise to advise on these complex bills, but I'm sure her committee can suggest appropriate amendments. Thank you again for your time, and especially thank you to Representative Nathanson for bringing this forward. It can make a big difference in us, the main operation of our organization. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to come comment on these bills. I've submitted written testimony. I'm just going to sort of hit the high points because it's a little bit lengthy. I apologize. I wanted to just clump them all together as all four. So the ACLU is in support of 3168. We think it's a great idea. We're neutral on 3330, and we are opposed to House Bills 2828 and House Bill 3331. I do also want to echo the thank you to Representative Nathanson. She's put in a lot of time and thought to these issues, and we certainly appreciate that. And also thank you to the chair and the committee from 2012. This issue did come before this committee most recently then, certainly in other times before, and we appreciated at that time your willingness to step back a second and move it to a work group, and we did. I was able to participate in the work group and really appreciated that participation. I learned a lot. These are very complex issues, and I think there was a lot of great work that was done there. So thank you. I want to reiterate what I've heard again today is kind of the problem that's been identified, which is that There's an inefficiency here, sometimes a duplicative nature of the way that we do criminal background checks for employment, and I think we're talking about employment, but also licensure or some boards, public boards might require a background check as well. So these are the people that we're talking about, and I think that's a very valid interest. It's expensive, as we've heard Megan Moyer say. It's it delays care, it delays employment. These are all things that we should look at. And I urge the committee to kind of keep that in mind, as this is our target problem as we're looking at these issues, and just be cautious of possibly taking a disproportionate approach to the problem as we look at things outside of that scope. So that's really the lens that I look at this through. So I'll just kind of briefly go through the bills. House Bill 3168, as I said, we do support this bill. I think it's the best approach to really get at the issue of duplicative background checks. The way it's described in the work group report is sort of a cluster system so that we're better matching the type of employment with the check that needs to be done and what types of crimes might disqualify a person through that check. And I think it's a great idea to revisit that. The ACLU would hope to be a part of that. I know it's I think it's being referred through this bill back over to the Department of Administrative Services to look at that, and to the extent that there's public participation in that process, we would love to be a part of that. House Bill 3330, we're neutral on this to the extent that we're moving from paper and ink fingerprint to electronic capture. I think that's fine as long as when we're doing that, we're preserving the protections that are in law right now, particularly the protection to not retain the fingerprint record and make sure that the security of that information is protected. I'm going to spend the rest of my time on the other two bills that we are opposed to, and I just want to make a note that Gail Meyer with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association had a conflict right now during this hearing, but would like to be associated with our comments on the next two bills. So what House Bill 2828, the way I read it, would do effectively two different things. It would repeal the requirement that's in law currently that when a criminal background check is done with fingerprints, that those fingerprint records be destroyed. And current law takes addresses that in two provisions. It says that when the state police gets those records, the state police must destroy the fingerprints. And it also says that the FBI must either send them back to the state police to be destroyed, or the FBI must destroy them itself. And our state law also says that if at any time the FBI does begin to retain the fingerprints, Oregon will no longer send fingerprints through the FBI. To my knowledge, the FBI is not retaining fingerprints for these checks. So there was some discussion, and so the second piece that House Bill 2828 would do is set up what's being referred to as a wrap-back program. I think where the name wrap-back comes from is we're talking about a wrap sheet, and so someone's the record of the wrap sheet gets pinged back, wrapped back to the employer or the licensing agency or whomever it is that's authorized to get that notification. And so the way I read this, and I would be happy to stand corrected if I'm reading this incorrectly, is that House Bill 2828 is proposing a state wrap-back system as opposed to a federal wrap-back system, which does exist. The FBI is working on a federal wrap-back system that I believe maybe some other states, and I don't remember how many, are experimenting with right now. This bill would say that the fingerprints may be retained at the Oregon State Police so that we might do a state wrap-back system. So two pieces. As I say in my written testimony, the ACLU has been involved for a very long time in criminal background check programs and making sure that there are appropriate safeguards in place to protect Oregonians when they get those checks done. One of the central protections is this fingerprint destruction requirement. We absolutely do not think it's the place of government to be holding a database or a collection or a file drawer or whatever it may be of innocent people's fingerprint records. That's a very important protection, and I think to repeal it in this context is really dangerous and a risky precedent to set. And so the second piece there that really is inextricably linked to the wrap-back program is that in order to have a wrap-back program, whether it be at the state or FBI level, we need to be retaining fingerprints, or at least it's my understanding that need to happen. So we have concerns with that. We have concerns with once those fingerprints are retained, the effect of the wrap-back system is that it would send a notification to the employer or the agency of any subsequent criminal record activity. And I want to emphasize that those notifications come at pre-conviction or arrest status as well. So really what we're doing here is creating a state where for certain professions where you might have to have a background check with your fingerprint, employment means a constant monitoring of even innocent activities that may be wholly unrelated to safe and competent workplace conduct. That's really important and really concerning from our perspective that we would start to go down that road. And finally, I did mention that from my read, House Bill 2828 does stop short of permitting retention of the fingerprints at the FBI level. But I think it's still very worrisome. I think that there's a high likelihood that we will inch along our way, session by session, to become a part of a federal wrap-back program. I know that at least one agency here in Oregon is contemplating that, has been for quite some time. And I want to bring to your attention, for those of you that are not aware of the program that's growing at the federal level, the FBI is working on what's called a Next Generation Identification Program. Literally from its website, it's described as a state-of-the-art biometric identification services system. So it's collecting electronic fingerprints, palm prints, photos, using face recognition technology, iris scans, tattoos. I mean, this is building up a collection of profiles on Americans at the FBI level so that they can be linked to names, associations, residents, criminal history, and in this context, employment status or employment history. I think this is all very concerning and something that we should take very strong caution in moving toward or even taking a step toward. And I think back to the problem that we talked about initially about duplicative or inefficient or costly background checks here in Oregon, I think that there are several other alternatives. Start with House Bill 3168 is a great idea and a great start to try to address some of those issues that we're having here in Oregon without really getting into these very intrusive options that, as we know, when we start dealing with the interconnection between what the federal government is doing, we very quickly lose control over that information.
Ms. Strauss, and did you want to talk about the other bill?
Yes, and I'll do so in about 15 seconds.
Okay, great.
House Bill 3131, we also have concerns about this. This is setting up a voluntary registry. I make 3 points in my written testimony, and I'll just point you toward those. We think that a system like this really has a invites discrimination from employment based on membership status in the registry, so we would want to take a hard look at the language, make sure that there are guidelines to make sure that that doesn't happen. Second, I think, again, point to the really the criminal background check system right now has list the crimes that might implicate your disqualification from employment, and what this system would do is say that any crime at all somehow carries a stigma of not being in the registry. So we're a little bit concerned about that. And then finally, I think I'm a little bit unclear about the utility of this, because you would still need to be doing federal checks of anyone in the registry. This is really going to only be checking on a periodic basis at the state level, and we're happy to talk about that in more detail and what I mean by that. Thanks.
Thank you. So our agendas look like they're getting longer. And questions? Representative Vega Peterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question about the current background checks. So once a background check is done on an employee, is it ever redone on that same employee?
If the employee stays employed in the organization, not necessarily. Part of our personnel policy is that if the employee is arrested mm-hmm. or has any criminal conviction, they are responsible for notifying us. Otherwise, we don't get notified, and usually we don't have to do. Now, if somebody... No. No.
Okay.
No.
I don't know if somebody else may want to address this. It's already spoken.
Chair Holvey, Representative Vega Peterson, I think part of the complexity here is that it's all over the map, from my understanding, and I think there are people in the room who can better speak to that, but depending on the licensure, but depending on the employment, you may get a periodic check, or you may have no subsequent check at all. So I think it's depends.
Okay. Then follow up. Okay, thank you, Chair. Do traditional background checks turn up information that has to do with the pre-conviction information, too?
Chair Holvey, Representative Vega Peterson, I'm going to defer that one to the state police to answer that one.
I can answer from experience, and you'll probably have more information, but experience. Now, the way it works for the adult services background checks, we have to fill out something called a 301 AD form. That gets submitted, and then we will get information back. And the way it works now and has for the last several years is it's the determination, fitness determination, is made by the agency. It used to be made by the state. Now that burden is on the responsibility of the agency. And so what you are given is their criminal background, but you do not get anything that was not a conviction. So we look at that, and then we make the determination based on their job and what their responsibilities, whether it would be they are employable or not. And there are certain things that are automatically eliminated. They are not employable if those crimes have been on, and it's a permanent issue.
For the record, Tricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police. I'm going to try and answer both the questions that I heard, if I could. So, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. The first question was, are there checks done after the initial check? And I believe that Becky answered that correctly. It does vary depending on the agency. The background check, the criminal background check, from my point of view, is the part that state police does, and that's at one part of the whole employment licensing process. So the agencies, by their rules, put in those processes that they will follow. There is a somewhat streamlined process under 18154 for the background check. It's those rules that describe how they will administer that whole process. And so some will do another check based on the residency or the length of time someone's been in a position. Some of them expire at varying times. So, yes, it is kind of all over the board. And then if I remember the second question correctly, when a initial check is done or a recheck is done, yes, it is based on any records that are current on the criminal history as of that time. So it may just be arrest information. It may be arrest and conviction or whatever the court findings were. Statute and this legislative body have given specific agencies the authority to look at the entire criminal history as it exists, both state and nationwide, during those checks.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. And, Representative Holmey, I'm also going to submit a written testimony from Tim Crawl, the executive director at Oregon Rehab Association. He was not able to be here today because he's next door.
Okay, thank you. Just hand it off to Samantha. Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearings on House Bill 2828, House Bill 3168, House Bill 3330, and House Bill 3331. And I'm going to move into a work session right now on House Bill 2667. And Bob, would you give us just a brief reminder of what the bill in general is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2667 creates a task force on procuring through small and local businesses, directs the task force to study public contract awards to certain businesses, including the types of contracts awarded and methods for promoting contract awards to those businesses.
Thank you. And committee, we do, if you remember, I had Representative Fredericks up on this bill before, and he went back and I believe got an amendment after our discussion from the last committee, and I'll leave it to Representative Fredericks to briefly tell us what that amendment does.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I am Representative Lou Frederick of House District 43 North and Northeast Portland, and I'm here again on House Bill 2667 to quickly explain the Dash 1 amendment. The amendment does two things, and I want to thank several members of the committee for helping me with this. First, it removes the sections related to carbon impact of non-local contracting. This might be an approach to look at in the future in order to encourage public contracting with local firms and to maximize the local economic activity generated by public contracting dollars in Oregon. And I agree that this is a separate debate and exploration, although one I hope we'll have at some point. I think there are some important economic and environmental questions that should be asked and answered. The second part of this amendment refines both the makeup of the task force and the charge to it. Now, as originally drafted, the bill failed to specify minority or women membership on the task force. Historically, we've found that when representation goals are expressed in aggregate, minority women in emerging small business, for instance, minorities and women are usually left out. So it did not address a common shortcoming of reporting on minority women and emerging small business contracting that the aggregated data can and usually does. It unfortunately hides significant disparities. So this amendment specifically calls for each appointing authority to appoint one member who is a minority individual or a woman, as those terms are defined in ORS 200.005. who owns or operates a small or local business. This will make up one-third of the nine-member task force. And it calls for the resulting report to illuminate the impact of contracting agencies' public contracting practices on minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses, each as a separate category, and further the impact on specific groups of minority individuals listed in the amendment. That's what the amendment attempts to do. I think it addresses a number of the concerns that several of the members of the committee had. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, do we have questions for Representative Fredericks on the amendment?
Representative, could you detail who was on your committee or who participated? I'm not familiar with that.
Who on this committee
participated? Or specific,
I guess, in general. I talked with a number of folks. I talked with, obviously, the Chair, Holby, but I also talked with Representative Richardson, passed along a couple of good ideas. And you mentioned some of the comments when I was first here. You also had some good ideas, and I appreciate those.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Not seeing any Representative... Frederick, I really appreciate your work on that, and I appreciate you showing up to walk through the amendment for us.
Thank you for the help there, and I should tell you that I'm hearing from a number of contractors and others who are most interested in this. They are looking forward to seeing what comes of this task force. So thank you.
So Representative Lively, we have a motion to adopt the -1 amendment, I believe.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2667. I don't know what it stated.
I got it. Representative Lively moves the adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 2667, dated 3-7-2013. Discussion on the adoption of the amendment? Any objection to the adoption? The amendment is adopted. And I don't know if we have a script for this particular motion, but...
I'll just go with it.
Good luck.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2667 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
We do not. We'll withdraw that motion. Any objection? We were sending this to Ways and Means, but we don't have the fiscal to send it down to Ways and Means so they can do the fiscal better.
So we just send it to the floor?
Yeah. So just withdraw the motion.
Okay, I'll just withdraw the motion.
Representative Wiley withdraws the motion. So we'll take that up at the next meeting. Got a little ahead of ourselves there. Sorry. Excuse me. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2667.
Thank you.
I will at the end. So with that, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3035. Bob, do you want to give us a brief description of House Bill 3035?
Happy to, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3035 adds school districts and community college districts to the public entities participating in the Oregon Transparency website, requires a school district or community college district to provide certain information, web links to the Department of Administrative Services to the extent practicable without reallocation of resources.
And I have up Tricia Smith, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I'm happy to be here today in support of House Bill 3035. This bill is a transparency bill, in our opinion. It will provide the public more opportunity to come to understand what our community colleges and our schools are going through on a daily basis, because they'll have more access to that information. This bill requires school districts and community colleges, as Mr. Estabrook said, to place their financial data, specifically revenue, expenditures, and contracts, on the Oregon Transparency website. And when we think about how that might happen, I want to first say why. OSEA hires experts that are really good at finding data and information. And so this bill actually isn't here because we believe that it will make our job easier. We've got guides that do that, and they find what they need. But because it takes us hiring experts to find that information, we know that the average person in the public doesn't have those experts. School districts have websites these days, so do community colleges. The Department of Education has much of this data already at the department. But if you're a citizen in a school district and you're wanting to know where the school district's money came from and went, you're probably not going to be able to find it on the Department of Education website, because you won't know where to look or what you're looking at, and you probably won't even know to go there to look. They may have it already on their own website. Fabulous. We wish all school districts did, but they all don't. This gives us and members of the public, which we are slowly, as this website grows and continues to become more and more of an entity that the public is aware of, this is going to be the go-to place. This is where people are going to come when they want to know how government works. And we think school districts and community colleges are a big piece of the government. And they should be there too, because that's where the public would go to look for it. Now, as Mr. Estabrook said, this bill, like the other transparency website bills, is very specific. It should not cost them any money. It should not require them to go create new data. It says, without further expense and using the data that's already available. What we expect this bill will do is provide school districts the opportunity to give DAS the links to that data that can then be placed on the website. We don't want DAS to have to go write a bunch of rules or spend a whole bunch of staff time on this. This is not our effort to spend tax dollars on things that we'd rather that money be spent keeping our members in their jobs. So we're not here to try to get you to spend a lot of money doing unnecessary things. We are trying to provide information to the public so they feel confident that we are spending their money wisely and that they know what we're doing. And that's all this bill does. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to add. Oh, one other point I'd like to make. The Chalkboard Project created a website a few years ago called Open Books, and its intention was essentially the same. But if you have gone on that website, what you find is very basic information, lovely pie charts, and basic category totals, but no real data behind it that you can look at. So while it's a good first step, and its effort was to do essentially what we think this bill is trying to do, it is not sufficient to provide the public the information they need to make good decisions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Richardson.
It may not be the right person to ask, but I'm interested in the cost of implementing this. I mean, if Chalkboard already has one, that they've already spent the money to do it, then why would we want to duplicate instead of getting them to update? So do you have any idea about what the cost would be to implement and maintain this?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, thank you for the question. I have 2 points to make on that first, on the question. The first is the bill says very clearly that there should be, and it says, when at no additional cost, using existing data and existing resources of the state agency. In the next case, it says state agency, but we're adding school districts and community colleges. So in terms of cost, the bill says there should be no cost.
Okay.
And if there is, they don't have to comply with it. And in terms of why not just use Open Books, the Open Books website is not specific. It's just very general information.
Representative Doherty.
Thank you. So, Tricia, you're thinking of something, let's say the Tiger-Tualatin School District. Would the school board meeting that they deal with budget or a budget meeting, is that those materials that would just be sent to the state or a link or something like that, so they're not creating anything, they're not whatever, they're just transmitting? Is that kind of the idea behind some of the transparency and how it would work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I don't anticipate it even being that complicated. What I expect is that districts would provide links to their financial data that exists on their websites.
Okay.
And they wouldn't be needing to transmit anything. They'll just provide the links. And DAS would tell them in what format those links need to be so that they work together.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Krisha, your purpose here is for greater transparency. Did I hear you say that you're also concerned with keeping members in their jobs? Was that part of your testimony also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson.
Certainly could have.
No, sir. My point was I would rather not spend money transferring data. I'd rather spend money keeping my members in their jobs.
Okay, perfect.
That was what I was trying to say, was that our school fund should, that my intention with this bill was not to spend a lot of school fund.
Thank you, appreciate that. Follow-up, ODE, I think, has this information from districts regarding district stuff, obviously, regarding employment data. They have capital construction data, all that's there. Why would we need to replicate this in a different venue than already is out there? If people are really looking for data and information, it's pretty readily accessible, I would think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, as I said in my testimony, we don't believe for the average taxpayer the information is readily accessible. Our experts know how to find it. But what we are hoping to do with this bill is include the public in what we're doing so that they have the easy access to this information. And the Department of Education does have this data, it's true.
Sure.
But it's very difficult to find if you're not well-versed in how it's there and what and how it's presented.
Follow-up. I would say that most of the data that a district, I'm talking about from the school district perspective, would have or would make available is really likely germane to residents of that district, the taxpayers and so forth, whom do come to our school board meetings, who do file requests for information and so forth. As they're looking for budget information, our budget meetings are all open public hearings. Mm-hmm. As you well know, we operate under public meeting laws at all times. And I guess it's just hard for me to see that those individuals who really would have an interest in whatever data that would be forwarded to this website wouldn't have a better chance to get at the local level rather than have to make something happen at a state level that maybe somebody from another part of the state's interested in seeking something out, but it's really not germane to their lives and to their business.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, from our perspective, we believe the government transparency website, as I said, is growing in the awareness of the public. It is going to become that go-to place for information about government. People think schools are government. They may go there, and we want them to be able to find what they're looking for wherever they go. If they go to the school district website or a school district board meeting and they can find it there, great. But if they don't think about that and they think about this is a great place for it as well.
I guess just one final comment would be that as a school board member, if my finance director came to me and said, you know, this is kind of going to cost me some time and effort and to do this, my response would simply be just forward the link or website link to the website and we're good because we've complied with what I agreed to be the intent of the legislation, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the bill does very clearly say when at no additional cost using existing data and existing resources.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
I mean, very quickly, thanks to the modern technology that we have now, I just accessed the Tiger Tualatin School District website, and they've got the budget, they've got the proposed budget, they've got budget minutes. And so I'm looking at this sort of thing that you literally just go through and say, state, here's the website for www.tdsd.k12.or.us, and everything I think that we're asking for is there. But I disagree a little bit with Representative Johnson, because to be honest with you, some people don't think about going to the district website. If there's some sort of thing, government transparency, and they go to the state one, I think, if it's literally just sending a link, I figure it couldn't hurt. So, and I think the more the better. If they go on, you know, Hood Rivers or they can go on here, I think is a really good idea. But everything was here. Their 206-page budget for next year proposal is on the website. So,
thank you. And I'm certain that, you know, that our school districts are of interest to all taxpayers in Oregon, as the state does finance a good portion of our school districts across the state. So I thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, I have John Wyckoff and Morgan Allen. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the panel today about this piece of legislation. I just wanted to raise a couple of quick concerns that we have about the implementation of this in ways that where we think that we could be a bit more specific about what we're asking for here. For the community colleges, and I think most local governments, we are under local budget law contained in ORS 294, which requires us to post information related to budget process, expenditures, revenues, and post all of that information, which the colleges all do on the website. So I think from a certain perspective, some of this may be redundant. However, we understand the goal to put this in a central place. And I think what we would like to see is that it be made clear that what we're not doing is having to standardize the information into a different format that that DAS may require us to do. Each of the colleges are locally governed, have different processes for this, but all have to follow local budget law, which requires information to be in a certain way. And we would want to make sure that if what we really just need is a link on the transparency website that links back to information that is already available, let's be clear that that's what we're asking for, and that what we're not asking is for the colleges or a school district to now put the information and spend time putting the information into a different format so that it can be posted on a website. That if the information's already there, let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's just be clear that what we need is simply a link to the information that's already available. And I think that's what we would ask, so that the intent of the legislation, which is we don't have to go through extra work and spend time, can actually be fulfilled.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Morgan Allen on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. I'd say ditto to what my colleague just said. We're fine with the intent of the bill and transparency. That's not an issue. As has been pointed out by several members of the committee, there's all kinds of data already out there. As a matter of fact, before I came over, on the Department of Ed website, all the data required in this bill is on there in 18 different searchable ways. You can break it down in any fashion imaginable as far as expenditures, revenues, etc. So it's all right there, and I believe it is pretty easily accessible. But what I'd add to Mr. Wyckoff's testimony is actually the bill, as you know, already has ESDs in it when it was passed, and so I called some ESD folks to see how it actually worked out, and what I found is that it was much more than just sending a link, and whether or not they knew they could not send more information if it was to create more work, they chose not to. And just to give you a couple examples of some of the quotes I got back from folks at ESDs, this was and is more work than minimal. It was quite a bit of work getting it set up statewide. I know one small ESD told me they spent 40 hours inputting data. So if you look at the current transparency website, the data is not in the formats that school districts or ESDs for that matter use at all. It's formatted in spreadsheets, and it's basically just a big data dump. So sort of in the spirit of mandate relief and not creating more work for districts. We would appreciate that clarification in the bill, that you could essentially just send in your budget document or links to what you have on your websites, and that would be good. Otherwise, what the ESDs ended up doing, and I think they probably did this in good faith effort, is they spent a lot of time formatting their data into what DAS wanted to put on the transparency website, not what was already available at the ESD level. And ESDs, we're talking about 4.5% of the state school fund, which is about $200 million. School districts, we're talking about, you know, $6 billion. So there's going to be an order of magnitude of more data if they get in disagreements with DAS about what they have to put on there. So again, fine with the bill. We agree with Mr. Wyckoff, more clarity about what exactly we're asking for districts to do.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. I think consistency of the format may be a different discussion, perhaps, at a different time. So I appreciate your, though, letting us know what your concerns are so we can hopefully address those. Nobody else left to testify on House Bill 3035. I'm going to close work session or public hearing on House Bill 3035 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3080. Bob, brief description of House Bill 3080.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3080 requires the Department of Administrative Services to update information on the Oregon Transparency website at least once every 6 months, requires documents on the website to be downloadable in one or more standard document formats, requires certain additional information to be posted on the website relating to actual expenditures, tax expenditures, cost analysis, and feasibility of procurements, and information on contracts.
Thank you. And I have Stacy Cowan signed up. If you identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Stacey Cowan with SEIU, Local 503. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3080. We had a member here on Monday who had hoped to testify for the bill. He wasn't able to return, so what I've done is submitted his testimony in writing, and my intention is just to summarize the points that he made in the written testimony. So House Bill 2500 was passed unanimously by the 2009 legislature to create Oregon Transparency website and established Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission. The measure was introduced due to interest in having Oregon join the growing number of states that are increasing transparency and accountability by posting spending and financial information online. The legislation was a great step forward. However, we think some adjustments are needed to make the legislation live up to its promise. The main goal for House Bill 3080 is to have the information presented in a more user-friendly way, as well as providing information in a timelier manner. The bill requires agencies that complete feasibility studies to post those studies on the transparency website at least once every 6 months. Currently, feasibility studies are only available to the general public through information requests. The bill requires information on the website to be updated once every 6 months. Currently, updates happen once a year, and it's for the previous fiscal year. So right now, it's current as of June 30th, 2012. The earliest next update is going to happen in January of 2014. So at that time, the data will actually be a year and a half old. The bill requires posting both the actual amount expended that agencies expend as well as what was originally authorized, and in some way tying that to the actual contract. Right now, it's challenging, or right now you can find out how much an agency paid a contractor, but it's difficult to tie that back to what the actual work was for, what the payment was for, and what work was completed. Lastly, the bill requires the information to be reported and presented in a manner, again, that's more user-friendly and easier to access in regards to date of contracts and state in which the vendor resides. Currently, it's difficult to sort expenditures by active date and determine how many active contracts the state has. As was mentioned earlier, the information is presented in a spreadsheet, essentially. And when you think about the information, the active date, expiration date, and I believe there's another origination date, are all included in one cell. So if I wanted to download some information, it's impossible to sort by active date. And when you pull it up for any given agency, you can see that there are contracts that range from contracts that are expired, contracts that are currently active, and contracts that go on for anywhere to 20 or 30 years into the future. So it's really challenging to actually parse through the data. It's also difficult to sort contracts by state in which vendors
reside to determine how many contracts are going out of state to vendors. So, for instance, there are zip codes that are listed. There's a section for a city address, so it's actually the address with the street name, and then there's a column for zip code. So I could sort it by zip code if I knew every zip code that were in Oregon, but again, it's difficult to really do an analysis of what business is staying in Oregon and what are we contracting out. We absolutely commend all of the amazing work that the legislature and DAS have done creating the website and maintaining it. There really is a tremendous amount of good information on the website. We just think that it's a challenge to make any sense of it. It is, in a sense, sort of a data dump, and you almost need a PhD in research to be able to dig through. It's taken a long time for me to get acquainted with the website and find information. And once I do find it, it's very useful, but again, it's very challenging. And so the question we kind of posed was, how transparent are we being if the information is really difficult to make any sense of? We'd like to ask for the committee's support to take the next step in creating a more an open government and a more an open transparency website. So thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions? Representative Richardson.
I have one. Thank you. I'm wondering why the decision to change the reporting period from annual to 6 months. In the reports that we get, it's almost always an annual report. And if it's 6 months, why not 4 months or 3 months? I mean, if we're going to make the agencies have to go and create additional data gathering time and additional reports to comply, was there a problem that 9 months was too long or a year was too long that we're trying to fix? Or did someone just decide if 12 months is good, why not six?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, thank you for the question. I think it was just, to be quite frank, that when I started really utilizing the website was at a time when the data was about a year and a half old, and just looking at, there was no real master plan in terms of the 6 months. We felt that the 12 months or the previous fiscal year was too long to wait, but recognizing that it's going to be a challenge for agencies to submit information more regularly and for DAS to upload it more regularly, so we thought by trying to have that time that try to strike that balance a little bit more between providing the information a little timelier but without trying to create too much of a burden. So beyond that.
Just to follow up, without one create too much of a burden, do you have any idea what the cost will be for agencies to have to comply with this where they're already doing it annually and now this will be an additional thing?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I don't. We've had an opportunity to speak with DAS, and this was a couple of months ago, so it was before we actually had a bill. We have been invited to participate in a work group around this with DAS, so our hope is to have a more detailed conversation about that, because again, it's not our intention to create a tremendous amount of work, but we do want to be thoughtful about how we're presenting the information. So I expect that that's a conversation we'll be able to have.
Yes, thank you. And I know as a policy committee, we never get those fiscals. That's a ways and means process, and so sometimes we think it's a good policy, we'll send it down there, and then as you know, the ways and means process will prioritize whether they want to spend the money or not. And so it's sometimes difficult for us to figure out what the fiscal of a particular bill is in front of moving it out of policy, unfortunately. Even if we ask, they won't give us that information until we actually schedule the bill for a work session, then we'll get some sort of indication. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3080. And committee, we're going to go to a work session on House Bill 2370. I'll open a work session on 2370. Bob, remind us what 2370 is.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Briefly,
Mr. Chair. House Bill 2370 requires certain additional information to be posted on the state transparency website relating to public meetings, administrative rules, and contracts, and reports regarding properties in enterprise zones.
Representative Thatcher and Senator Roebling.
I wouldn't want to come up and ask on the work
So we have a committee, we have an amendment to this bill to consider, and I'm hoping that Representative Thatcher can tell us a little bit about that amendment.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representing Kaiser St. Paul and Newburgh, and
thank you for allowing me to come back for a work session and for us to amend this bill to reduce the at least perceived fiscal impacts on the agency. And also like to thank Representative Lively for joining us as chief sponsors on this bill. Yes, we did work extensively with the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Revenue to ease some of their concerns about some of the fiscal and administrative heartburn they were feeling when they read the original language. So we drafted some minor amendments that softens the language and gives the agencies more flexibility. And just briefly, changed the language around the parts dealing with posting minutes from public meetings, administrative rules, and information about contracts. DAS interpreted the bill as originally drafted that they would be required to go out and collect all this data. And so we changed it to simply say that the state agency shall provide that information to Department of Administrative Services. We also made sure that we were not reinventing the wheel, and we said the information had to be already available on the website. We know how, you know, if it doesn't exist and they're having to do what they were talking about with the ESD, that does cost some extra time to go into it. And we also want to make sure that what we are linking to and what is on the website is disclosable under the public records law. You'll notice similar nuances in the section about local government transparency websites. We wanted to emphasize that this is strictly voluntary. We are not going to require DAS to go hunting for these things. It's just allowing that if a local government wants to have DAS linked to their own transparency website at the local level, that could happen. But DAS doesn't have to go and track any of these down. That was never our intention. Finally, related to the economic development tax break section, dealing with the enterprise zone specifically, this just makes sure that we are honoring the intent of the law that we already adopted unanimously last session, 2011, last big session, I guess. We wanted to cover every different sort of flavor that we invent on the different enterprise zone tax exemption law so that the state agencies who review the reports from county governments would be covered. It would just cover them all. Hopefully with the changes we've made here, the annual reports on county property tax exemptions for enterprise zones scattered around the state will be able to be posted on the transparency site and, of course, still allowing only for the what's allowable under public records law. So that's it.
Great. Questions for Representative Thatcher? Senator Roblin.
Thank you.
Concentrating on calling you Senator.
I know. Thank you, Chair Holvey and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin, the Senator from District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and over to Sheridan. I'm excited to be here and to hear the hear what we have for the amendments, because this, a little history, it's been now four sessions, 2007 or 9, I can't remember, but a group of us came together, two of whom are sitting here, Jefferson Smith and Mr. Wisnett were the other two, to start on an adventure on transparency. We had come together because we had maybe different reasons for wanting it, but a real strong, firm belief that the state does its best work in the open light of transparency, and that the more eyes that look at things, the more opportunities we have to find those savings and those other opportunities to make government more efficient and streamlined, and that in other states where they had started doing this transparency stuff, amazing returns came in from regular citizens who looked at these websites and had a particular issue that was really important to them, and they bore into it, and once they got the information, they came with information to legislators and said, you know, you could do this a lot better this way. And those efficiencies helped those states save lots and lots of money. It was our hope that we'd do the same thing, and we started out with one commitment between the four of us, and that was that we would work with DAS to do it in such a way that it didn't add more burden and cost more money, but to do it efficiently. And as you can see, we are consistent with that by having the amendments that are here today. We have had exceedingly good people to work with at DAS over the years, and you know, finding that person as people move is always difficult, but the consistent thing is, as we think about different things and as ideas come to us from constituents and others about what to put out there, then our job is to go back and work with DAS to find out how can they do that without costing them money, just putting it up and making available to citizens around the state more information about which to help us do the best job we can efficiently. And I commend Representative Lively for their also working together to do that, and I enjoin him, because what we found out when there were only four of us, everybody told us we would never get anything. I mean, we had both our caucuses and the governor saying they didn't like our bill. And eventually, towards the end of that, because we stayed true to our course about not costing any money and doing other things, other people came to us and said, we have these ideas we'd like to put in with you. And we found we were gathering more and more steam with more and more people who felt, okay, this is where we'll start, and maybe we can get more. And that was always our intention. Here's where we start. What do we find as we go forward? And I really appreciate the fact that we have consistently done that. We've added things every session since the first bill came in to make it more robust and to give more information to citizens around Oregon. It's not that, I will tell you, when I looked at what we had the first time, it was a lot more than I thought we were going to get, and I'm not interested in a lot of it. But I found that I have constituents who are interested in every little bit of it. So, you know, that's what's exciting about our state, and it's what's exciting about the citizens. It really gives every citizen an opportunity to take their interest and their expertise and then bring it back to life through legislation like we're having here today. So I encourage you to add the amendments and to pass this bill. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to be here. It's really exciting to be over here in the House side.
Any questions for Senator Roblin? Senator, I was sort of curious, and speaking of transparency on the Senate side, it seems a lot darker over there.
We have darker wood, and it takes a little while, and you know, come over and visit us sometime, but you seem to be so absent.
I was
a House member, I used to go over there all the time, took chocolate, asked them if they had anything that I could help them with.
I was actually in your...
I keep waiting to have these...
You're waiting somebody to do that.
For you to come on over and say hi.
I was over there last night about 7 o'clock going through your outer office looking for chocolate, but I didn't find any.
I'm sorry, I'll have to leave some out for you. There is candy in a little machine. You can, it makes noise, but you can kind of work it if you want.
Okay, well, I really appreciate you coming over.
Yeah, and, thank you very much.
And giving us that.
Again, thank you for your efforts and the work you're all doing over here.
Committee, we'd like to go ahead and adopt this amendment, and unfortunately, we're still waiting on the fiscal on that amendment, so we won't be moving the bill today, but let's get the amendment adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt -1 amendments to House Bill 2370, dated 3/14/13.
Representative Lively moves we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2370. Dated 3/14/2013. Discussion on the amendment? Not seeing any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2370, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2381. Bob, remind us of what this bill is.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2381 authorizes state agencies to establish voluntary contribution programs for projects of public interest for which no or inadequate funding exists. It directs the Department of Administrative Services to establish a voluntary contributions account in the general fund and subaccount for each program established by a state agency. I should note that the bill has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Lively, a motion?
I move House Bill 2381 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
With the subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, with subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2381 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion on the bill?
One quick question. There was a question about whether it could be swept. Did anyone ever find out about that? Just curious. Does not affect my vote, so. No one's here.
I would answer that to be yes. I don't believe anything that's in the state purview has the ability to be swept.
It's not in the Constitution. It doesn't matter what it says. It's right. Notwithstanding blank, with 31 votes, it's going to be blank.
Somebody who's participated in sweeps before.
I've seen it happen. It's a horrible thing.
Thanks. We had an expert here to bail me out. So, any other discussion? Not seeing any. Samantha, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Megan Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Oh, excused.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Having House Bill 20, House Bill 2381 having received the required votes has passed to the Ways and Means Committee, and so we'll close. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2381. And Bob, I think we've completed our agenda. 29. Oh, excuse me. Perhaps we have not. So we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2931. Bob, remind us about House Bill 2931.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2931 creates a deferred maintenance elimination fund and authorizes the state treasurer to issue bonds or certificates of participation to fund state facility maintenance, requires DAS to work with the Capital Projects Advisory Board to determine condition of state facilities and extent of deferred maintenance needed for each facility, requires DAS to submit a plan to Legislative Assembly for creation of a deferred maintenance database, and so on. The bill does have an emergency clause, and there is a -1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Can you describe the -1 amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the proposed -1 amendment simply exempts the State Parks Department, or the State Parks and Recreation Department, the Oregon University System, and public measures from this particular measure.
Thank you. Representative Lively, motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2931, dated 3/20/13. Approval.
Representative Lively moves the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2931. Discussion on the adoption of the amendment.
Discussion
on
the amendment.
On the amendment. We're exempt. The amendment exempts the parks.
Okay.
And department and the OUS system, essentially.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why.
We already have a plan, I believe, for parks.
You're correct.
They already have a maintenance plan where they're working through that systematically, and I don't know what the origin of that was, but I've had conversations with them over the past year about that.
Correct, and that is essentially why the governor's office and the parks.
I think OUS is probably similar. I think it would be redundant, perhaps.
Yeah, and it was
put them in the
redundant.
Right. That's my understanding.
I think is there somebody here from the Parks Department?
Oh.
Yes. I was just looking at him. He's sitting there nodding, so we might as well get him to come up and explain to us why your program is so darn good that it doesn't need to be included.
Chair Holby, thank you. My name is John Potter. I am with the Parks Department. As Representative Johnson referred to, the Parks Commission had requested a state park system plan, a strategic plan, to try to keep the Parks Department working on the dedicated funding from the lottery that it goes towards the maintenance of the state park system, and so it would never have to draw upon a fund like the one this bill speaks to. So we were hoping that the asset management system that the Parks Department already maintains would be adequate, and that we would not have to commit resources and time and effort to try to standardize and work within the system that DAS is developing. That's the primary
Thank
reason.
You. And I don't know if there's somebody here from the governor's office or anywhere else talk about why we're exempting OUS and higher education institutions.
And I assume we now do.
And we do. and so welcome and Thank you for hanging out and
sure.
being here to answer this particular question.
Representative Holvey, member of the commission, Jack Kenny, Capital Finance Manager, Department of Administrative Services. With the movement of the Oregon University system through Senate Bill 242 in the 2011 session, outside of the purview of the Department of Administrative Services, the department, the university system was already exempted from capital finance planning under ORS 276. So it was never, I believe, it was not the intention of the bill to bring OUS in, and this just clarifies that. That's
correct.
My understanding.
Correct. And that was a discussion. We kind of figured that they weren't included in this bill, but we wanted to make sure it was clear, so we added that language. So that is the answer to those questions. Other discussion on the amendment, on the bill, or on the we're on the amendment. Never mind. Excuse me, on the amendment. Seeing no other discussion on the amendment, is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2931 as amended to the floor.
Oh, excuse me. Hold that motion. We do not have the fiscal on the bill as a total, so we will be carrying this over. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2931. So, committee, we are unfortunately carrying over several bills, carrying over for work session.
Yes.
We're carrying over House Bill 2667, House Bill 2667, House Bill 2370, and House Bill 2931. That are being carried over for work session. And for our public hearing, we're carrying over House Bill 3070. And we will keep House Bill 2856 and 2536 on the agenda to be carried over as well. So now I think we've completed our agenda for today. And thank you very much. And we will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.